Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And we greet you from the frozen depths of High Wycombe. The muskies outside are toiling through the snow and hail and other unpleasant things.
Around here,
well,
it's being that really annoying just above freezing so that it doesn't act like properly cold. It's just bleeding uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's not the funnest time of the year, but we're here to bring you fun, talking about our frustrated ambitions, mostly. But first, Roger.
Thank you for putting some money in our tip jar to John Hagen and Brian Parker.
Thank you very much, Governors. We appreciate it. Us humble folks, we'll throw another log on the fire in celebration.
But before any of that, if you have money that you don't give to us for some bizarre reason, we may talk about the bundle of holding.
Once again, we should remind you that our friends at the Bundle of Holding send us free samples and ask us to push their current offers, which we do when we think there's something interesting in the offing. And this time, we've just heard of an offer which is more interesting than appealing, I think, to me. but let's talk about it anyway. This is... Come on.
Well, it's basically a bunch of solo RPG stuff, and solo RPG is, well, it's a bit like solo board gaming. It's a thing of itself off to the side of the main hobby. I came into it through what one might think of as the mini games that we've talked about before that were in a lot of classic RPGs.
Yeah.
Like, you know, designing spaceships and especially the Traveller trade system. You can look at that and see, yes, all right, this could be a game in itself. You know, start with a ship here and see how much money you can make.
Yeah.
And there, I can't remember the name of it. If I find it, I'll put it in the show notes. But there is actually a supplement that is specifically this. You know, here is some stuff you can add on to the Traveller trade system. To say, okay, you know, this is the sort of random encounter you might have. But the basic idea of this is a substitute for a GM. So you might start with an actual scenario, you might just randomly generate stuff, but essentially it's whenever you would ask the GM something, like, do I recognise these guys, heraldry or whatever, you can make your skill roll if the system supports that, but ultimately you get a random yes-no table. And sometimes it's a yes, and also, and sometimes it's a no, but that kind of thing. It's improv prompts. And the idea is that as a player, you're obviously aware that you can choose whatever you like from the auto GM, but the idea is to play it as fair as possible and, you know, try to survive through your own skills and whatever against this essentially random challenge. Random but guided.
Yeah. What we have here is called parts per million, three parts per million.
Yeah, that's one of them. There's a whole bunch of stuff in this offer. That's one of them. There's also, you know, a solo thing for Stars Without Number. There's a solo thing for... I need to look at it now.
For Masks and Monster of the Week, for basic role-playing. There's two general titles, Player's Guide to Solo Role-Playing, and three easier solo play, easier solo game journals, easier solo mystery play. And there are a lot of parts per million doing things for specific systems.
Mm.
13th Age, Dungeon Crawl Classics, Mothership, Stars Without Number, Tales from the Loop, Trophy, whatever that is, and cut-up solo books, text snippets to inspire your games. Well, I have once tried doing journaling role-playing games. That was with A Thousand-Year-Old Vampire. Mm-hmm. And I tried it for a while, and it didn't sustain my interest. I can see why people get into it, but if I'm going to write something, I'd really just rather write something rather than treat it as a role-playing game.
Yeah.
I think that when I write things, role-playing game habits bleed into my role-play, into my writing, all that I can do.
I think the idea of this is not so much that you're using it as writing prompts, though obviously you could, but that you're exploring the world, the setting, maybe the system.
Yeah.
Perhaps in a, if you have a, you know, no, you don't have any local groups that want to play this game. You don't want to do a play by forum, which might get horribly overcomplicated, as you know, traditional forum games tend to turn into walls of text.
Hmm.
Maybe you don't want to do a sort of live online IRC, Discord, or whatever. This is a way of finding it in a relatively safe context. There's another one for the current Star Trek game. There is an official solo thing called Captain's Log or something of that nature, which is basically, okay, here is a bunch of random generation tables so that whenever you have a question that you would ask the GM can say, no, you didn't get into Starfleet Academy, and here's why.
Mm.
And then you build off that to say, okay, how am I going to build my life after this? That kind of thing.
Okay. I regard these as valuable materials, but I can't feel enthusiastic about it as an exercise in itself. I'm going to have a look at them, but I'm not instantly enthused.
Yeah, it may well be that this is not for you. Just as with solo board gaming, it's not for a lot of people. I certainly found during the acknowledged part of the pandemic that the things I enjoy about board gaming are the physical bits and the socialising. And if I'm playing online with strangers, I don't get either of those things.
Yeah.
But
I've had good experiences running things online, but no, that's an irrelevancy. This is interesting, but I'm not quite sure what to do with it.
I think, to be fair, if what you want to do is what we think of as role-playing, this isn't really a substitute for getting together with a group, but it is perhaps a way of exploring a system or exploring a setting that you can't immediately get access to a play group for.
Hmm. And there are a lot of those, as we shall probably mention a bit later on.
And that is running till, let's see, 3rd of February.
All right. This month's main session is prompted by a question, or I think it's really two questions, from friend of the podcast, Shemin Beck. What are some things, stories, concepts you've liked the idea of adapting for gaming, but have not been able to work out how? Also, apropos of Madness Dossier, what game settings, etc., attract you, but you can't work out what to do with them, or not very much?
Yeah, I will come back to the comment on Madness Dossier later.
Okay.
The first thing that strikes me is there are some sorts of story that can be very satisfying to read that don't work well as RPGs, at least for me and for the people I know. And the first thing, I may be misusing a technical term here, stories that are, I think the term might be dramatic in a very narrow sense, that they are about somebody's personal growth and overcoming their challenges in terms of their state of mind, much more than they are about external events.
Yes. I have a copy of, but I've never actually managed to play Good Society, which is an avowedly Jane Austen romance simulator about... It's a bit Bridgerton in the presentation of different ethnic groups, but it is intended to be late 18th, early 19th century persons of good standing in society, persons with a little bit of money, and their interrelationships and trying to work out their various emotional entanglements, which you felt good about, but I didn't see how it could be made to work.
I still never actually read it. Sorry, I have read it, but I've never actually run it.
Yeah, no, I have no idea of how to start. But yeah, this is all internal. And you can write a book about this sort of thing. Many people have, and you review a lot of romance novels on your blog. But I don't know how you can make it into a thing that isn't scripted around a table. And yes, you can act that sort of thing, but I don't think you can improvise that sort of thing easily. Too much of the structure of it is in the hands of an author, in the hands of fate, and it doesn't feel right for the sort of chance-based, simulation-based gaming that is at the root of what it is that we do.
I'm not sure it is impossible to do this, but I think it would look a lot less like a standard RPG than even the Good Society does.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about games that do in some way model personal growth other than being able to hit somebody with a sword better. GURPS. You can buy off a disadvantage in GURPS, and maybe yeah. that disadvantage was, you know, a fear of something that was related to something traumatic in your past. But the rules just say, well, if you have the points and the GM lets you, you can buy off that disadvantage. That you don't have to conquer a thing related to that fear in order to remove that fear. And another disadvantage might be your code of honour, which similarly you can get rid of when you have enough points.
I think I like more, from a role-playing game standpoint, the idea of initiation into a mystery, which is one of the core mechanics of Ars Magica.
Hmm.
Ars Magica also expects you to make an adventure out of conquering your personal limitations of transcending what you started out by being. And sometimes that's very dangerous to do in a world like Ars Magica, and sometimes it's very revealing and very satisfying.
I mean, who really needs a physical body anyway?
Humanity, poof, throw it away. The whole thing of changing your character and your character changing in response to circumstances, it's very much embedded in Pendragon and in modern RuneQuest Glorantha. That sort of thing, it sort of works by chance, but it also works by the small decisions that the players weigh. Am I going to invoke this part of my personality or that, given the two of them are in some conflict? If I dedicate myself too much to this, will I lose that? And that makes for a random dynamic system, but sort of works and gives help to the role playing rather than totally controlling the role playing.
Yeah, the traits and passions that were first, I think, seen in Pendragon, though we've later learned that this was Greg's original idea for RuneQuest 3,
yeah.
Are very good indeed at producing the sort of random bouts of madness that Arthurian characters suffer.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're necessarily good for other settings, but I think that may be one of the reasons they haven't been generally ripped off by other games in the way other mechanics have, because there are some sorts of story that they just aren't a good fit for.
I think that sort of thing is embedded in Unknown Armies and to an extent Over the Edge as actual mechanics of Unknown Armies is all about making hard decisions about what you do to keep and get and keep power, and that the sort of personality changes that power brings is very much at the heart of the game.
Just one more thing on this, that I don't want to suggest that personal growth, character growth, doesn't happen in other games, in games that do not mechanically have explicit support for it. It happens as an incidental part of the mechanics, yeah. as part of the players playing the character and thinking, okay, I think that Bob the Fighter has now got over this fear or has now come to terms with yeah. whatever. And that's great. But it feels very delicate, and the more I try to wrap it with rules, the more it seems as though it might accidentally get crushed and become, you know, the fate. This is the sword of my father. Okay, you get plus two. So
yeah. I think that sort of resolution, however, is only there. It is dependent on the strength of the player's memory and the player's note taking.
Sure.
To carry on, to make it consistent. I've seen people take random events and wrap them into a central part of their character, just because it sounds like fun.
Absolutely.
Where there's a mechanic to support it, then it feels a little more real and a little more solid. But that's, again, illusory. I have on my PC in the subfolder marked games, in the subfolder marked prospectuses, a list of some of the things I have planned to do over time. I've put to my players and they have told me no, don't. Or I have just abandoned. But this is a record of all the ideas. I've divided it up into two sections here. The published settings and worlds that I find difficult, and my own ideas that I find difficult. And some of the same processes are there in both of these, but all of this is overwhelmingly in the shadow of my personal laziness. But I remember looking back at the start of my role-playing career when I first discovered this weird hobby, and I was mad for adapting the books that I'd read and enjoyed. And one of them was the Derrini series, Catherine Kurtz's books, mm-hmm. about a sort of pseudo-Britain with a species of, with a humanoid variant of people who could do magic and were oppressed for it.
A pseudo-Wales, to be very specific about it, but yes.
Well, it's a pseudo-Wales that got itself attached to pseudo-Britain and then got itself attached to the rest of the European continent, which is... And it still manages to have Christianity as it is in the real world, as part of the background. There's an empire over there. They crucified him. That sort of thing. And I ran up against a first problem, which is that the author is creating the systems and the events of the world and the reality of the world to support the narrative they want to tell, and not out of a strict love of world building. And even when the fudge-based Derrini role-playing game was published, I didn't find myself able to figure out how the magic worked and what it was and wasn't capable of doing, because that was definitely undefined and definitely not something that the author was interested in.
Ah, now I have the book that you may actually need there.
Which
is called Derrini Magic, which is a combination of a short story anthology and a list of Kurtz's notes on what the magic can do and can't do and how you do it.
I have it, but it didn't help me enough.
Fair enough.
I also have the Encyclopaedia Derrinicus, which is one of those obsessive collections of everything about the setting, all the characters, all the things and places that were mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's enough to make me pick it up and have a look and then think. It's called Codex Derrinicus. I can see it right where I'm sitting. And sometimes that inspires me to pick it up. But yeah, where there's a central part of it that doesn't make sense, that hasn't been made for random person to pick it up and use it and tell stories with it, then that I find extremely difficult.
I think it's possibly worth noting. I don't know what adventures are provided in the Dyranny RPG. The one I have played, which I think is in the RPG, because I have only played it, not run it. You're not nobles. You're not, you know, kings and bishops and stuff like that. You're a bunch of travelling players, and a lot of your problems involve finding a missing sheep. Which is, frankly,
you're asking players to find sheep. Madness.
Which is much more along the lines of the sort of small-scale classic RPG stuff. But it is not the sort of thing that I would expect to find if I were saying, right, let's roleplay in the world of the Dyrinni, which is about, you know,
princes, kings, evil bishops. People brooding all the time. There's a lot of brooding.
Everybody you like dying. Well, maybe not that bit.
Oh, well, no. But happiness comes eventually when the author decides they don't want to take the series any further.
Yeah, I was thinking of this also in the context of The Lord of the Rings, which has had several official RPGs. And it is notable to me that they are there is basically one big story, and this is even mentioned in the book. There's a bit of, I think it's in the Return of the King, where Sam's saying that, you know, the story we are in now, taking the ring to Mount Doom, is part of the same story that is part of our legends about the Silmarils and, you know, the light of the Silmarils. Yeah. And some of that very same light from the Silmarils is in the thing that you are now carrying. And yeah, which is great, but there is just this one big story, and what do you do if you're the PCs? And the answer that the games have taken is set it at different times. So I think the current one, it's basically between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, so there is the darkness encroaching, but you don't really get to do anything big about it, because that's going to happen in The Lord of the Rings. The Iron Crown version, Middle-earth role-playing,
Fourth Age,
so after the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
The elves are going away, magic is leaving the world, but you can still have adventures in it, that kind of thing. Or to take an extreme version, friend of the show, Bill Stoddard, has run I can't remember the title of it, but basically the idea is the Ring Quest failed.
Yeah.
The darkness took over the world, and hey, congratulations, you're now resistance fighters. Which, as I understand it, was a very satisfying game, but it is not the sort of game you would think of if you said, let's play in the world of the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Once you have to go, I think it's almost inevitable that you have to go to the places that the published material doesn't go to in order to do some proper creation. There's an alternative route, which I think we've all seen, of questioning the premises and doing a version of the basic structure of the adventure, which in some way subverts or challenges the reality that is in the original inspiration. And sometimes that's good and fun, and sometimes that's very subversive.
And sometimes
it destroys its own fun. Sometimes
it becomes Philip Pullman's what's the series starting with the Amber Spyglass?
His Dark Materials.
Yeah, which my reaction at least was, first two books, quite enjoyable. Third book, oh boy, you really don't like C.S. Lewis, do you? And you're going to tell us at great length how you don't like C.S. Lewis.
You really don't like the idea of God, do you? And you're going to tell us about that as well at length. Oh my.
That is a valid form of literary criticism, to write a version of the story in which a certain assumption is not assumed. I'm thinking of Cameron Hurley's The Light Brigade as a comment on Starship Troopers. Which is, you know, yes, that's all very well, but if you did it with actual real greedy people in charge as opposed to people who can be completely trusted to act for the good of humanity, it might not work so well. But anyway,
yeah.
Another thing that occurs to me is, when there are definitely stories in which a significant part of the fun is the interaction between the characters.
You know, yes.
Here is the team, here is the found family, however you want to construct it. And again, sometimes players will do that. and it's great. But it feels like an optional extra. It's not the core business of what the game is about. And if the game relied on that happening, it could feel very bare if the players weren't in the mood for it at that particular moment. And TV shows in particular, obviously books as well, but what you get is a scriptwriter sweating for many hours, and possibly with help from other people, to produce the 42 minutes of snappy dialogue. And expecting a bunch of players to do that, it's not going to work as well, typically. There are a lot of games that feel to me as though they are written for always-on players. You know, you are enthused and energetic, and at every moment you're ready to jump in and say, aha. But sometimes we're tired. Sometimes we've had a hard day at work. Sometimes we just want to kick back and cruise for a bit with our mates. And it's the traditional RPG does at least let you do that. If you can just say, okay, I'm just, probably not explicitly, but maybe one of the players is just saying, okay, yep, I'll go along with that. What Robin Laws in Robin's Guide to Game Mastering called the casual gamer.
I think this is a problem that either solves itself or it doesn't. I think I've just started a Monster Hunters, GURPS Monster Hunters campaign with my regular Wednesday night group. Mm. And they have each of them chosen a template, and each of them chosen a thing that they can do. And they are a new team of Monster Hunters underneath a mysterious patron, getting things together and finding things out.
Sure.
And already they're starting to, I can start to bring in their backgrounds and their personal enemies and the history that they have and that hasn't been revealed.
Okay.
And that builds depth. But yeah, sometimes it can be supported by a specific set of, by the group as a whole, having mechanics and having strengths that they can build up.
But you have also, I believe, run Monster of the Week, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Do you not feel, as I do, that in Monster of the Week you're much more relying on the players to say, aha, I need to jump in here with my ability and do X to make things bowl along, whereas in a more traditional RPG like GURPS, brackets Monster Hunters, you have the ability to say, okay, your enemy shows up, or you know, your contact isn't available or whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe it's me, but that's...
So far, GURPS is working. It's supporting what I need supporting, and I'm going to have to get a lot more vicious with them and start attacking them with more monsters. I can see that already. I was going to say, that what you've just said about the feel of the group, it's a problem I'm having with a project that I've had at the back of my mind for a long time, which is to do some sort of game, even only a one-off, about Noggin the Nog. I did some research. Part of the problem here is there's very little material for the original. There's a couple of DVDs and some books. And it's not a setting that allows you to go off with different non-famous Nogs. Your characters are going to want to play the king and his court up there in the mythic and bloody cold north.
And presumably you want it to retain the feel of Noggin the Nog specifically, as opposed to mythic Vikings generally.
Yeah, this is... It's very beautifully written. It's very... And I can feel myself tempted towards two temptations. Allow them to take the Mickey. I mean, it's supposed to be humorous. And there is a character who is the greatest warrior in the kingdom and also a complete coward. There's the mad inventor who comes up with wonderful ideas which almost always turn out to be terrible. And there's the king's son and heir who at 10 is a lot more sensible than anybody else in the group. But I can feel the temptations towards either making it more Mickey-taking And that's a direction my players would take at the drop of a helmet. And going off into deep seriousness and nastiness and finding some deep secret behind the sweetness, the pleasantness, the whimsy of the original. And doing whimsy in a role-playing game is surprisingly difficult.
Mm.
And maintaining it as a tone is difficult. And one of the reasons I'm hesitating to do it is that I don't know if I can... I'm pretty certain that none of my group are actually of an age to have seen Noggin the Nog when it first went out.
I confess I've never seen it. I'm
it's very
in
cute.
Passing, but...
And I'm almost turning towards no. This is too fine for our rough hands to pollute, type of thing.
Something with which I do have rather more familiarity would be Asterix.
Yeah, now that's more boisterous, more jokey all over.
But who do you play?
Ooh, well.
I mean, do you play the named characters? Do you play interchangeable background warriors? Do you play Romans? I mean, I suspect the model one might take would be something like Asterix in Britain, where here is a place we haven't been before, and yes, here too there is one small village that is holding out against the Romans, and it's got its own people whom we haven't met before. And I think one would might work.
They drink this stuff called tea. I don't know. The jokiness of Asterix, the blatant jokiness, the puns and the satire and the caricatures make it a little harder to adapt. I don't know why I feel that Discworld is suitable material for gaming, but I'm not quite sure Asterix is. But for one thing, because Terry was at least at one point a role player, and because he thought about, I'm giving him posthumous immortality already. He thought about world building and about consistency and about what would be a cool idea to introduce now.
Well, also, at least in the earliest books, he was taking off role playing cliché as a part of the general fantasy cliche that he was taking off. And obviously it caught its own flavour later, but that was there at the foundation, and I think that's probably helpful.
I'll say, Shimmer mentions madness, does he? Is that something specific to you?
Well, it's an example of a game that... a setting that is not easily compatible with the way I run things. I have run it. But it's got this lovely high concept. You know, the entirety of reality is a lie. There are these Babylonian/Sumerian deities that treat humanity as slaves, and they used to be in charge, and then some dubious reality quakes went off. And now humans are more or less in charge, but they're still out there, and they're trying to fight their way back. And you are the few, the brave, who try to deal with them.
Hmm.
This is great fun. There's some gorgeous imagery, and you know, you for example, you're walking down an alley in, I don't know, Bolton on a wet Saturday night, and suddenly there is this hot sandy wind, that kind of thing. It's a lovely stuff. But what are we going to do this week? What does an adventure look like beyond the very broad, well, there's an intrusion into reality and we need to do something about it? How does that take form? That's really not clear to me. I should say, by the way, that this is its own GURPS supplement, as I've looked at it. It appeared in more condensed form in an earlier version of GURPS Horror.
Yeah, I think part of the implied background is that you are fighting against not just the monsters, but the minions of the gods who are want to Restore the old reality.
Hmm.
And you're also fighting against your own controllers because it's a conspiracy based. It's a conspiracy based setting, and
well, also because this is a Ken Height setting, there is this whole, you know, only we truly understand the nature of the job. We have to do horrible things in order to save you sheep, all that stuff, which I'm not a big fan of, but it can be made to work. Even so, as I say, I have made it work. But it felt like an awful lot of work to keep a campaign running.
Yeah.
We have talked about this before in a slightly different way. I've said in some of our earliest episodes that one of the problems I had was I've got a great, lovely high concept, but I don't know how to insert the PCs into that when the PCs are thinking in terms of, you know, how do we get enough food to last the winter.
And I'm finding a little bit of that with my current fantasy campaign. I had enough to get it started. I had enough to show them the world gradually, but they're coming to the climax, and I've got to decide what the nature of the problem, the monster, the dilemma they find when they climb to the top of the mountain up to heaven is going to be. And I'm feeling a little daunted, more daunted now than I was when I started. I find there's a step beyond that where I don't even get to the I don't even get to understand what is going on in the world. I've got a list of this stuff. Lots of it is by Monty Cook. Stuff like Invisible Sun and Numenera. I just can't get a handle on it. I can't decide what's normal for that world and how people who are growing up in that world work their way around it and discover what's going on. The most refined, exalted, and incomprehensible thing I ever came across was the supplement for the Exalted, the role-playing game for the Fair Folk, which was all about these things that hung around on the edge of reality and invaded it and tried to corrupt it. And they were expressed in terms of philosophical and literary qualities, I think. And something of the same problem hangs around the depiction of fairy in Ars Magica. It's just too bloody weird to get my head around.
They're supposed to be incomprehensible. That doesn't make them gameable.
Yeah, quite. It makes them quite the opposite of gameable. You don't want too much mechanics in that sort of thing. You want practical hand wavium is what you want for the threat of something that goes to the very core of existence, knowledge, and reality.
I mean, one version I've seen in games is they have the mentality of 5-year-old children and nuclear weapons.
Yeah. There are worse things than nuclear weapons, and I think the Fair Folk get to have them.
But that is an idea one can easily comprehend and put into practice. Whereas, you know, while putting together the latest issue of The Path of Cunning, we found ourselves saying, right, well, how do we find in our stock illustration library that the concept of postmodernism has never developed in this world? I mean, how do you illustrate that?
Oh. Since I'm not sure I know what postmodernism is.
It's the reaction to modernism, which is the really 1920s, 1910s,
yeah,
where everything is now, you know, brushed and chrome and sleek and all that stuff.
And from what I'm reading, was, according to your article, was the postmodernism invented by the CIA?
Or no, it's getting started a bit earlier than the CIA really got into that game. But also, it was an explicitly anti-fascist thing because a lot of modernism went fascist, and frankly, the CIA would have been pushing in the other direction. So,
Well, the modernist fascism is at the core of Mussolini, and Hitler sort of rode on the coattails and incorporated a lot of 19th-century German theory about nationality into it. It's a horrid process, and I don't want to think about it, especially just at the moment. I've got another list of games which are keeping on the shelf because of reasons of the buy-in, the difficulties of buy-in, where I'm facing the fact I'm just going to have to, either I'm going to have to start a new group online and sacrifice another part of my leisure time to maintaining it, or I'm just going to have to put it firmly back on the shelf and not use it however much I want to.
And that, harking back to the beginning, is the sort of thing that the solo RPG space is designed to help you explore.
Except as we said at the beginning, that's not giving satisfaction to the bits we enjoy.
Fair.
I mean, there has been a tendency to, in modern role-playing design, to create very specified, very outre definitions for what the group of characters are and what they do. And that is a tension. I mean, I want to do some of these things, but it's not the systems that produce them are not easily adaptable, are not generalizable to, and it makes it more difficult to find players who are equally interested in the specialized subject. Now, Ars Magica, obviously, Unknown Armies is up there because an idea of occult conspiracy and the price you pay for power is not appealing to everybody. And in Ars Magica, the price you pay for power is endless fiddling with the systems and the background, which, some people like it. It's as I say, it's the model railway instinct
To the
in
research
people.
spreadsheet.
Aha! To Wikipedia! Oh, and to the Oxford History of Medieval England. Yeah. I have one other example of published systems I want to mention, which is Harn, which I think is partly due to the primitive, all right, early, all right, classic, but nature of the setting, which they've tried to develop it over the years, but it hasn't developed in the way that better settings and better systems have done so. You've got this lovely, harsh medieval thing with a layer of fantasy stuff over the top and at the bottom, but I can't quite work up the enthusiasm to do the amount of work that would be necessary to bring it up to date. And the way the gatekeepers of it have developed it hasn't appealed to me, which is irritating because I've got this half a bookshelf full of Harnic material that I'd like to make some use of, but
I fear
I think it's too late.
this may be one like RuneQuest and Traveller and Empire of the Petal Throne, where you've got this hugely detailed setting, and if you got into that gradually year by year as it was coming out, then this just makes sense.
Yeah.
And if you're coming to it as an outsider, then my goodness, how much do I have to read? And the answer is quite often not actually all that much, but finding out which bits you have to read can be a challenge in itself.
Yeah, it's the GM's job. I mean, a Harn can be anything in a medieval setting, from brave knights and nobles down to the squalid thieves of a capital city, and all of those are established cliches you can make use of, and they just need a bit of setting briefing And you can do that very gradually. But as I say, there are problems with the set, with the setting, and with some of the stuff that isn't there, that I don't feel like my overwhelming laziness overwhelms me in this case.
There's also the question of, yeah, if I'm going to do three quarters of the work of putting together a setting, in bringing this up to full resolution for the players, why don't I just do all the work of putting together a setting and do my own thing?
In this case, the answer is because I'm not that good an artist. I cannot provide the maps, the visuals, the research that's gone into it. I'm not sure it was the right sort of research, but it's a large amount of research, and it makes an appealing kit of ideas I could do something with. I have mentioned in the past a collection of school books about various imaginary cities in various parts of the world. First one I picked up was Barmi, spelled B-A-R-M-I, which is sort of North Italian, Southern French city from the earliest Roman times up to the 20th century. And I've been trying to find a way to make use of those books for some considerable time. My best shot was an Innominy game set around the North African colony, which goes from primitive to Roman colony to fully fledged Islamic city and up to the 20th century. And playing that with the same group of visiting angels was very entertaining. I've got somewhere in the back of my mind an idea about a time travel based campaign set in Barmi, in which the children of the city slip from time to time and reinforce and correct the history of the city. And it's very vague, but it's something I want to do before I pass on.
Shades of Buck of Pook's Hill.
Yeah, except this is an entirely fictional city where they live, and they're not going off to France or America to find the interesting people from the period. It's the history of their own home city. That could be fun, I think.
I'm also just remembering that. Ooh, let's see, this would be mid to late 80s. A lot of GMs said, you know, this game is set in a city. Wouldn't it be great to have a detailed listing of everything in the city? So, you know, we're in this street. What are the shops nearby while we're having this fight or whatever? And both Cyberpunk 2020 and Shadowrun did bring out city books. I never heard of anybody actually using them in that way. It was much more, okay, we need to find an X, you know, high-end cyberware supplier or whatever. Okay, look it up in the book. That's where they are. We will go there and do the thing. It never seemed to take on that feeling of reality of we are walking down the street when a thing happens. That may have been the GMs doing it, but I was one of those GMs. I never seemed quite to get into that setting.
There was something about Parvis. Maybe the fact that it was the part of Chaosium's house campaign where it was tested, that gives it a better level of realization than that. But I am really looking forward to seeing what Robin Laws has done with it, and depicting it after the Lunars have been kicked out and before Argrath Whitebull sets off to become savior of the world. I don't want to judge Robin by some of the remarks he's made on his podcast about the strange feeling it's been to run RuneQuest. So I'm going to wait and see, but I'm going to be interested. And I will say that some of the material that's being produced for the Johnstown Compendium, which is Chaosium's RuneQuest fan-made publications, is very good. There's a supplement which is a pseudo-Roman insular apartment block in the lunar capital of Glamour, which is really very nice for a small setting that you could build out from. It shows a lot of promise, and that's a recommendation too, as is pretty much all of the Johnstown compendium. I was going to say the other half of my list. The other half of my list. There's a title for you. More evidence of Michael's egomania is the projects that I've got in the prospectus folder, which I have never got around to actually selling to anybody, or actually completing in some cases. And this is my own ideas I find difficult. I've got one which I bring up every single time for the Winterval, which never gets done, is because it's a LARP. The idea is that this is, on one side, the team from the United Nations of Earth, who have been sent up to orbit to talk to the aliens who have just arrived. And on the other side, it's the alien embassy from a slightly fractured galactic federation, each of which is out for something for themselves. And they do have the option of destroying this upstart new race right at the start, because it might be, you know, for the greater good. And I can't write it because it's a LARP. I've got five players in both my groups, and I can't do both sides and in the same session, even an all-day session. So I'm not quite sure how to reconcile this and how to do it with the players that I've got. It's a nice idea, I think, but it's not one that I think I'm ever going to pull out of the bag and do the hard work on.
I have no experience of conducting LARPs, so...
All right, so no comment.
Sadly.
All right. Well, try this one. This is another one which is down at the bottom of my things to do bag, which is I've been lusting to do a Dune-ish based role-playing game about the Imperial Court of the Galactic Emperor and the hangers-on and the adventures that people have there. I don't want to do Dune itself, because there's just too much inherited lore that I have to take into, but I want to rip off Dune quite heavily for the sort of Ruritanian flavour of it, and the backstabbing and the dueling and the various noble factions trying to get something out of it.
What was that game a few years ago? It has its own setting. Fading Suns, that was it. Fading Suns.
Yeah.
The stars Suns are gradually going out, but nobody really seems to care about all that much, because there's politics to be done.
It went a bit. It has a bit of a heavy. Even for me, it has a bit of a heavy religious overtone to it, and I wasn't that enthused by it, perhaps because it went for the gloomy side of the Dune setting of the corrupt and decadent and the people who are no longer properly human thing, like the Spacers Guild in Dune. I don't know why I haven't put more effort into this. Perhaps my players don't like the idea of being Ruritanian. I think it ought to have a feeling of the Three Musketeers if I'm going to get to do it, but I'm not quite sure how to work that into the setting. Have you got lists of ideas that you have put to the back of the burner?
Yes, but since it appears that my GMing life cycle now is overcommitting and then mildly burning out every few years, I'm trying not to keep too many of them hanging around.
I forget about these from year to year, and I I go back when I'm thinking, well, what shall I do next?
And so, some time ago, in about 89, 90, 91, I was running a play by email. Well, in, for those of us who had email, game.
Yeah.
In many cases, physical letters, in which each player took on a cyberpunk corporation. And this started off with, I think I used the stock manipulation system from Torg Nippon Tech World Book, which was very primitive but could be made, could be bashed into shape. But what it rapidly turned into was, okay, here is this system that we could use, and if we're doing those things, we can do those things. But what we're much more interested in is the role playing of messages exchanged in the game. Ranging from insults to subtle manipulations, and I would like to do something like that again on the basis that I really enjoyed it, but I'm not at all sure what the magic combination was that caused it to work. So, but it's a thing I would like to consider. You are the head of a faction rather than you are a scrappy independent.
Yeah, that sounds like, what was it called? It's in one of the Different Worlds issues. There was a diplomacy setting set in a fantasy world which grew and never came to a conclusion. It became all about the boasting, the story details being filled in, all about the creating of the world, the creating of the character interactions. It happened a lot with En Garde well, where the mechanics of the game became less and less important, and the social role playing around a deadline and around a publishing date became more and more important. The comment becomes the point, and the game mechanics become just the thing that you're dancing around.
Yeah, I think it's particularly the case for something like En Garde, which we've talked about in a previous episode, because particularly considered as a role-playing game, it is frankly mechanistic. I mean, it would not. There is certainly software that will auto-moderate it, and I could see software to auto-play it as well. It would not be impossible. It would not even be particularly challenging. But that's not the fun bit.
That's not the fun bit. The fun bit is the publishing the results, is the publishing the justifications that the players put out for their actions.
It is writing the newspaper article to give someone cause to duel you.
Yeah, quite. And that sort of thing requires a light touch. But I don't know why. Perhaps I ought to try the Imperial Court thing as a play by forum or play by email type thing, because maybe my players just don't want to do that around the table. And
it seems it depends on who they are, who the characters are. But the more one is immersed in the business of the court, it seems to me the more one would be acting independently anyway. You know, I may have this guy as my ally in many matters, but we're not allied on everything.
Yeah.
So sometimes a thing is my purview. Sometimes we will work together on it. That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a game of a lot of individuals in the same setting, rather than a lot of individuals in the same cause working together, which is what normal tabletop role playing games do best, I think.
I think what would be. And yes, on the one hand, you can have explicit opposition. On another hand, you could have, well, you know, we all broadly agree that, whisper it, the Emperor is getting on a bit and he's not really able to run the Empire anymore. We may disagree quite violently about the preferred solution to that.
Specifically, ahem, who gets to be emperor afterwards? But ahem, pointing to self. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe in all of these, some of these cases, I am trying to use the wrong tools to achieve the end. I want to mention. I think this may be the last thing I want to mention, is I've had a project for a while to try and create a magic school setting. Because they are so fun, and they are, it's a cliche and a set of things that people enjoy doing. There's a number of enjoyable works for it. But I think the problem here is a technical one, if I'm going to use any existing game system, is that this is a part of the adventurer's existence that gets swept under the rug in the process of creating the adult magician. It is never detailed enough, and I think if you're going to create an interesting process of learning, you have to design something specific for the particular stage of life these people are at, and that requires a granularity that isn't wise in a role-playing game about adult characters.
I think that's true in terms of world design as well. Thinking of the literary examples of magical school stories that have stuck in my mind, they are about the school setting with the magicians in it. They are not about what the adult magicians do. But also consider that in your traditional fantasy RPG, a starting character, including a starting wizard, is fairly rubbish. I don't think you should design a magical school set of mechanics to produce a starting character. And if that means they are more powerful than standard wizards, well, that's fine. They're in their own separate world.
Yes, I think the interesting thing is both the technical choices both the technical directions that the characters want to develop into and the emotional up and down. But this brings us to the point near the start, that role-playing games aren't good at. It's about changing as a character, becoming a more mature person. And on the other hand, and on the third hand, I have to say that being an adolescent again is not an imaginative experience I want to go through. This is assuming, you know, that I've got through adolescence the first time by now.
That, I find it very tempting to put together a GURPS-style character template with, you know, poor impulse control, all the rest of the things, and then you decide as you mature, are you going to put these points into buying off your ability to get into trouble without even trying to, or are you actually going to learn something this week?
Oh, that's a nice dilemma. I like that dilemma. I think separating your points into dedicated pools. All right. That is actually a thing that's easy to do with GURPS and is an interesting idea. If I were writing my own system for it, I think I might do something that I really normally dislike and have multiple types of experience points. Possibly. Do you want a maturity or a skill? Is it this arete or wisdom that you're looking for? Yeah, all right, write that down, Michael. Arete, wisdom, arete, wisdom. Are those the thing? Which is more important to you, knowing how to do something or knowing what to do and what not to do?
For that matter, I think it would be reasonable to say that a particular sort of experience might well be not even just a maturity point, but, okay, this is going to act towards this particular shortcoming that you have.
Yeah,
at least if you apply it to that, it will be more effective than if you apply it to something else.
I think, wisdom. Okay. Yeah. That actually makes sense. I revolted against the idea of multiple experience points whilst reading Burning Wheel, which annoyed me immensely, for excessive complexity and too much rigidity. This is how we do it. Not a I know there are people who love it, but I'm not one of them.
Well, a milder version of that, which I think I've talked about before, which I think believe was invented by a friend of the show, John Dahlman, is in character generation. So, say the basic idea is we are normal people with weird powers. And in GURPS, you might say, okay, you've got 300 points. The trick to that is to say, okay, you've got 50 points, which you can only spend on weird powers. And you can move some of your main point supply into that if you want to, but you must spend at least that much, because otherwise it's very tempting in a system like GURPS with all sorts of social advantages to say, well, I'm charismatic and rich and all the rest of it, and I don't actually have any magic, which may not be what you want in a game about the doing the magic.
Yeah, quite. A minimum spend on the thing the game is nominally about. And you can't get out of it by being Batman. I have lots more projects in that folder. But there are definite reasons why I haven't gone on with them. Some of them I'm really quite proud of as bits of writing, but some of them are not anywhere near complete, anywhere near maturity.
Well, remember that it's a computing truism, but I think it's a writing truism as well. The first 90% of the project takes 90% of the time. The last 10% of the project takes the other 90% of the time.
You have said that before, I seem to recall. All right, let us wrap this up. If you have the projects you have been struggling with since forever, and you want to tell us about it, you can contact us via
Leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
And we may even give you the valuable advice we have accumulated over the years.
Don't do what I did. It was terrible.
Don't do what this other fellow did. It was even worse. We'll be back again as the winter continues next month.